welcome to the Science Podcast for November 30th, 2007. I'm Robert Frederick. This week, sexual dimorphism in a fossil hominin species, iron fertilization experiments in the ocean, and hot plasma outflow from the Orion Nebula. All this and more, plus our usual roundup of stories from Science Now, and we'll read from your letters to Science Magazine.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the Science Society, publishers of Science Magazine, advancing science and technology for the benefit of all people. The American Association for the Advancement of Science at www.aaas.org.
Sexual dimorphism. In humans, it means that boys still take longer to mature to adulthood than girls. But in other species closely related to humans, sexual dimorphism can mean vast differences in body size, facial structure, and even coloration, as with the silverbacked gorilla. In a paper in this week's Science, Charles Lockwood and colleagues report on the sexual dimorphism of Paranthropus robustus after an examination of some fossils of the early hominin species, which lived about 2 million years ago. Their study suggests that males developed much more slowly than females. Males monopolized groups of females, and that harem reproductive strategy also left many males vulnerable to predators. I spoke with Lockwood from England, where he works at University College London.
Well, basically, the study gives us a picture of social behavior in the species because it tells us simultaneously about how males are different from females, how males grew up, and how the way that males developed actually affected their life in a different way. In particular, that they appeared to have left their groups when they started to reach maturity, and then for a long time they continued to develop. And during this period, they were especially vulnerable to predators. And so what we have is a lot of males in this fossil sample that were probably killed by predators, and also some evidence that their social groups were essentially groups of females dominated by one male or possibly just a few males. So we usually refer to that as a harem structure or a one-male, multi-female structure. But in any case, males were pursuing a strategy of life, a reproductive strategy, that emphasized basically a high-risk, high-return strategy. The ones that made it through this period and eventually became dominant were probably quite successful, whereas many of the males were not. And this is exactly what you see in gorillas and a variety of other primates, but not so much in humans, and it's not true of chimpanzees either.
So what fossils did you examine? Where did they come from?
Well, the fossils are from three sites: Dreamuland, Swartkrans, and Kromdraai, which are all cave sites in South Africa near Johannesburg. The largest sample comes from the Swartkrans site, and this has been known for a long time. But the study was really inspired by new discoveries at Dreamuland, which was a site that only began to be excavated in the early 90s. And there's, in fact, one key fossil in all this, the small female skull that we talk about in our paper. It really, as a discovery, kind of shook up what we thought we knew about this species. And it turns out that our view of males and females in the species prior to this had been mistaken, mainly because there were so few females in the sample. Some of the small males were thought to be females and that sort of thing. But when you take into account the larger sample, and especially the small skull from Dreamuland, it appears that you have quite distinct differences between the males and females. And then some of the less robust males are simply the ones that hadn't finished growing up.
Could you describe this female skull in particular?
Well, it was discovered in 1994 at the site of Dreamuland by a group led by Andre Kayser, one of the co-authors of the study. And it was immediately clear that this was a much smaller individual than we were used to, and it was published as that. So that immediately told us that sexual dimorphism was probably higher than had been thought. And the main interest of the current study is it goes beyond that, not simply observing the difference, but making it clear why the difference developed, and also basically explaining why some of the skulls that had been thought to be female before are not actually females, but instead just small males. It's also true that this skull is important because it's the most complete skull of the species, and in fact, it's the most complete skull when it was found by any South African early hominin. So it's a very nice specimen. It's basically a complete skull.
Other than the dimorphism, were there any other explanations for why this skull might have been smaller?
Right, well, this gets into the general issue of how we know which ones are the males and which one are the females in the first place, because obviously they don't come with symbols attached to them. And it would be possible to say that this one particularly small scale was just the end of a distribution, and there weren't actually that many differences between males and females. But this is where the large sample of fossils comes in handy, because even though lots of the other specimens are not as well preserved, there are several fragmentary pieces that basically tell us there were individuals that are just the same size as this very small one. It's just that there are not that many of them. In other words, she wasn't unusually small for a female. There were some others in the sample. But because they're not that well preserved, people didn't pay much attention to them before. And what you do actually see is there's this group of relatively small specimens, including her, the nice skull, and there's a group of much larger specimens. And there's not much in between. The only ones that are kind of in between are, again, the individuals that are fairly young in age, despite being officially adult in the skeletal sense.
What's the name of this hominin species, and how is it related to us?
Yeah, we did our study on Paranthropus robustus, which is a robust australopithecine. And the relationship of this species to us is that about 2.5 million years ago, there was a split between this species group and our own lineage. So in other words, the robust australopithecines are close relatives of our genus, the genus Homo, but they're not directly on our line.
So in sum then, because this wasn't on our line, it suggests that at least 2 million years ago, this kind of sexual dimorphism hadn't yet been curbed, potentially with the group that would later become modern humans?
Ah, well, this is the big question. There are two ways to think about this. Now, generally speaking, we think we see high levels of sexual dimorphism in other species, things like Lucy's species, Australopithecus afarensis, which is very much close to the human line. So that's why we started to ask the question, when did it reduce? Now, in this case, what we're doing is adding a new kind of evidence to this type of interpretation or this type of analysis. And the real importance is that with this one species, we have this detailed reconstruction of social behavior. And it gives us a set of questions we can then ask about other species. So we sort of think we know already that there was this decrease in the human lineage and we don't know when it was. But this kind of method may give us a lot more information about that and may actually change our minds. It's quite possible that Paranthropus robustus did this for some reason related to its diet. And this is an important question to figure out. Was it actually a common pattern in early hominins, or was it a particularly distinct pattern that evolved in this species for some good reason related to where its resources were?
Now, you said earlier that these males were often alone. They may have been hunting these resources, presumably because they weren't a part of the group and were kicked out by the dominant male. Or why was it that you said this fossil sample was largely created by predators?
The part about the predators isn't just, that doesn't begin with us. In fact, the reason we're able to make that conclusion is because people have said for a long time, for more than 30 years, that these sites, and especially Swartkranz, was basically formed by predator activity. So it fits exactly the model of a set of bones that you would expect to find from victims of predators. We were able to use that information in forming our reconstruction, but it's definitely not something that we just came up with. It's very important that we were able to rely on that previous work.
So a predator would attack one of these hominins and take it and drag it into a cave and eat it there?
Yes, either drag it into the cave and eat it there, or eat most of it just outside the cave, and then the parts that remained, especially the skulls, would have gotten into the cave just by falling in or washing in.
So
we had this image of a young adult, unsuspecting male walking through the landscape and being killed by a predator, probably because he was on his own, and possibly because he was in unfamiliar territory, having grown up in a group of animals and finding himself on his own.
Wow, that's kind of gruesome.
Well, it happens today very much, too.
Oh, sure, sure.
Various monkeys and apes. We often forget that this is a fact of life, really a daily occurrence, or a daily challenge anyway, for many primates. So when we start to think of our own relatives that way, then these things come into focus.
Well, thanks for bringing it into focus for us.
Okay, thanks very much.
Charles Lockwood is lead author of a paper on sexual dimorphism in a fossil hominin species. Read the paper in this week's Science. Also in Science this week, helping plants survive otherwise toxic conditions. Plants require small amounts of the element boron to survive, but too much boron can also kill, and that's a problem for agriculture in arid and equatorial regions. Now, two papers published by Tim Sutton and colleagues from Australia's University of Adelaide and by Kyoko Miwa and colleagues from the University of Tokyo have both zeroed in on an approach to engineering plants so that they're resistant to boron toxicity. The key? Boosting the activity of genes that express particular kinds of boron transporters. These transporters are the molecules responsible for regulating how boron is pulled into and pumped out of the plant system. You can read the papers in the November 30th issue of Science. Drop enough of the element iron in the right place in the ocean, and it can trigger an enormous algae bloom. Some scientists think that artificially creating such blooms will take carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere and sink it to the bottom of the ocean when the algae die. In this week's Science, news writer Eli Kintish takes a look at these iron fertilization experiments and the debate over this controversial way to address global climate change.
If you want to cut down the amount of carbon dioxide in the air that's causing climate change, one strategy might be to store the carbon in plankton grown in the ocean. And that plankton can be grown by iron. And in the same way that trees are planted to take carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, some want to try to solve global warming by growing plankton in the ocean. Plankton, which is a kind of algae, would take in carbon dioxide, and if, like a tree, it can hold the carbon dioxide for a long time, it could be a storage for carbon dioxide from the air.
Has there been some experiment recently that prompted the thought of using iron as a way of doing it?
Since about 1990, there have been a dozen or so small-scale experiments which were meant simply to test whether iron catalyzed the growth of algal blooms. It had been a mystery why in some places in the ocean there's plenty of nutrients but no algae. Algae is kind of the base of ocean food webs. It's like grass or trees and forests. And it turned out that one of the answers to this mystery was that iron catalyzes the growth of algal blooms. And these small-scale experiments were focused on that basic science question.
How is this technique viewed by the rest of the scientific community?
Iron fertilization, this seeding of iron is called iron fertilization. It's a controversial process within the science community for a number of reasons. The first reason is that there's a question to which there might be side effects to catalyzing the growth of algae with iron. One is you could grow algae which is harmful to humans or somehow affects other marine life, algae which puts out toxins. You're messing with large ocean ecosystems, and scientists aren't sure what the side effects might be. The second side effect to iron fertilization might be the growth of bacteria or ocean life, which creates other greenhouse gases. So you'd be taking in carbon dioxide, but actually creating nitrous oxide or methane, which would actually reverse the positive impacts of taking carbon dioxide from the air. The final reason that iron fertilization to fight global warming is controversial is some scientists question whether you'd be able to quantify the effect you're having at all. For example, if you were in some places to bring carbon dioxide from the air into the ocean where it would make up algae, perhaps in other places that you're not watching, nitrous oxide could be produced by bacteria, or the carbon could be moved by ocean currents to a place where it would get to the atmosphere.
So the idea is that these algae take the carbon out of the atmosphere, and then when they die, they sink to the bottom, but it's possible that that carbon could be getting back out to the atmosphere in some other way. It's just that scientists don't have any way of measuring that. Is that right?
Here's the way that iron fertilization in the ocean works. The iron catalyzes the growth of large algal blooms, which take in carbon dioxide. When the algae die, or when they get eaten by microorganisms and other plankton near the surface, the carbon in their bodies, or in what ate them, falls to the depth. As it falls, it gets processed by the food web that's there in the ocean. At any point during that processing, the organisms which are eating the carbon respire carbon dioxide, just like we do when we eat plants. And so the trick is to get as much of the algae's carbon as deep as soon as possible. They're not sure yet how that might work. Some of that carbon may be in the things which eat the algae, and some may be in the dead algae itself.
And sometimes it's being turned into nitrous oxide. How does that work?
Some of the bacteria which process carbon in algae respire nitrous oxide or create methane as a side effect. Methane and nitrous oxide are both very potent greenhouse gases. Each of them are much more potent a greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide is. So that if you take in carbon dioxide from the air with algae and you respire some methane, you may be actually doing more harm than good.
So there's a real potential detriment to not knowing exactly what's going on with this.
The debate among scientists is how much uncertainty is acceptable. Right now, some scientists feel that the process will never be feasible and that you won't be able to quantify how much carbon impact you're having in total. For that reason, they think we should focus our efforts on other ways of fighting climate change. The experiments that have been done so far have been on the small scale, up to about 3 metric tons of iron. The kind of experiments they're talking about that a number of companies and countries are thinking about doing are the next generation. Instead of focusing on basic science, those experiments would focus on whether you can use iron fertilization to bring in large amounts of carbon dioxide, And to do that, they're talking about dumping as much as 30 tons, 10 times as large an experiment.
Now, you said something about companies. Why would companies be involved in this? I can understand countries wanting to reduce their greenhouse emissions. Why would companies be doing it?
The reason that iron fertilization is a hot topic right now is because there are now markets for carbon credits. These are credits which either countries must buy as a result of the Kyoto Climate Protocol or the European Carbon Trading System. The other market is a voluntary market where people can go on the internet and buy carbon credits to offset energy-intensive things that they're doing. In both cases, the mandatory and in the voluntary markets, companies see iron fertilization as a way to sell credits to individuals or firms that want to offset the carbon that they're using. Similar offsets exist now for trees, both in the voluntary and mandatory markets. This commercial interest is driving the buzz around iron fertilization.
So it's a money-making operation. Is that what you're telling me?
It's unclear right now whether anyone will ever sell a single credit by iron fertilization. In the voluntary market, there aren't strong standards per se. Any company could announce tomorrow that they're claiming a carbon offset through an iron fertilization experiment. That would be a voluntary action, and it would be up to the public to decide whether that company is acting ethically or whether there actually was a carbon benefit. If a company wants to sell credits through the Kyoto or the European trading system, or I guess through the Chicago trading system, which is here in the U.S. for voluntary markets, they'd have to show scientifically that there was a net carbon gain by these experiments. You're pulling carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere that otherwise wouldn't be entering the ocean. And you're holding it for a long time. That hasn't been done yet.
Does it matter at all where the iron is dumped?
The excitement around iron fertilization stems from the fact that a relatively small amount of iron can allow you to grow massive algae in places where the nutrients are there, but the algae isn't. And so you just need to find a place where it could work. Those places include the equatorial Pacific off the coast of South America, the waters of the North Atlantic, and what may be the best area for this, the Southern Ocean, which is around the Antarctica. But one of the risks that scientists are worried about is that by jump-starting growth of algae in the ocean, they might be tinkering with a food web and somehow mess up what is a delicate balance.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot, Rob.
Science News writer Eli Kintos reports on iron fertilization experiments in the ocean. Read more about it in this week's Science. Also this week in Science, a journey to the center of the cell. The cell nucleus is more than just a holding tank for chromosomes. It's a constantly changing, dynamic environment that breaks down and reforms with each cell division. It also builds ribosomes, which help transcribe genes and assemble proteins in the rest of the cell. Yet, for all of its importance, scientists know surprisingly little about the structure of the nucleus or how it works. In a review article this week, Laura Trinkle-Mulcahy and Angus Lamond explore how new techniques in both imaging and proteomics are starting to provide an ever clearer picture of the nucleus and how it works in real time. It's part of a special section on the nucleus in the November 30th issue of Science. Just below the belt of the constellation Orion lies the Orion Nebula, host to thousands of stars and a favorite astronomical sight for amateurs and scientists alike. Now in a paper in this week's Science, Manuel Gödel and colleagues report observing something in the nebula that's never been seen before, million-degree plasma that flows out of the nebula. The team infers that this phenomenon must be common across the Milky Way galaxy, as well as in other star-forming galaxies across the universe. I spoke with Gödel from his office at the Paul Scherrer Institute in Switzerland.
If you look at the Orion Nebula, which is a famous nebula in the optical photographs that you can see in magazines, it is dominated by a very bright region, the so-called trapezium region, where there are a few hot stars. This is also the optically brightest region of the nebula, but the nebula is much larger. And if you look at an optical image, also in the infrared, in fact, you see something like a circular or near circular or probably spherical, near spherical cavity. And we looked at it in X-rays and actually found a very hot gas cloud in that nebula that emits X-rays. And the origin of that gas cloud is the subject of our paper. And we had made measurements with our X-rays. This cavity-like region, it seems to be quite empty. There is not much gas that absorbs the X-ray. So it seems to be a nearly empty region. Of course, there's always some gas there. And if we check where our X-ray emitting gas is located, it's actually inside this cavity. It seems to be filling up that space, and that makes a lot of sense, of course.
Why?
We have estimated the pressure, for example. The pressure in our gas is just about balanced by the pressure of the gas around it. And, you know, this is a nice argument that the gas is actually nearly confined by the Orion Nebula. It does flow out, but it is approximately in a pressure equilibrium with the Orion Nebula.
What do you believe to be the cause of these X-ray emitting gases?
We believe that hot stars in the Orion Nebula are heating it up, and it's flowing out of the nebula in the interstellar medium. That's what is entirely new in this observation.
And how did you make this observation? With what satellite? X-rays don't reach the ground here on Earth, do they?
No, they don't reach the ground. We used ESA's XMM Newton satellite, which is in Earth orbit and records X-rays that are indeed what is emitted by hot gas of about 1 to 2 million degrees in our case.
Now, the Orion Nebula has sort of been a favorite of X-ray satellites for decades now, especially with the Chandra X-ray satellite. What was it about this Newton platform that brought about this discovery? Did you just look at somewhere else?
Indeed, there are two factors that came together here. First of all, we looked at a region in the Orion Nebula that is a bit away from where Chandra looked. It's in fact a larger region around the region where Chandra looked. And indeed, that's where the gas is found, and that's where we could see it on the detector. And the second thing that is perhaps important is the energy sensitivity that XMM has. We are very sensitive to very low energy X-ray photons, and they are emitted by our gas. There are no hard photons, or not many at least, so we need the low energy sensitivity. Well, that helps detect a relatively cool gas. It's still a plasma, but it's a relatively cool gas of about 2 million degrees, which is much less than what we see from young stars that are also embedded in the Orion Nebula.
What are the implications of this million-degree plasma that's around the extended Orion Nebula?
Well, one point that we discuss in our paper is that the gas is slowly flowing out of the nebula, because we can estimate this from pressure measurements that we can do with the data, with the spectra. And the outflow of the gas means that it flows into the interstellar medium, which is also hot gas usually, but we can actually even see where the gas flows. It seems to flow into a large bubble in the interstellar medium that has been known before. And in that sense, we identify from the Orion Nebula a new source of hot gas that enriches the interstellar medium. At least this is new in the sense that the Orion Nebula isn't an extremely massive star formation region. It's a sort of average star formation region. It has been seen in very massive star formation regions. But here we see it in a common one, and there are many of those in the galaxy, so that we suggest that, in fact, that many places in the galaxy we see this plasma outflow phenomenon from star-forming regions that enrich the interstellar medium on a large scale across the galaxy.
So this diffuse X-ray emission is going to be present throughout our galaxy, and so by extension, other star-forming galaxies?
Yes, indeed. That's what we assume as well. There are galaxies that have much, much higher rates of star formation, much more like the Orion Nebula. Everywhere in the galaxy, there are much more stars being formed every year. And in those cases, we would suspect that there's more X-ray gas actually produced in such star formation regions, indeed.
What does that mean for our overall understanding?
Well, one of the implications that we begin to think about, there have to be calculations that must be done now, is the interaction of the hot gas and its radiation with the molecular material in which it originates. There is molecular gas around that hot bubble in which stars really form, because stars normally form in cool gas, in molecular gas. But the irradiation, of course, now transforms some of this molecular gas. It may irradiate shells that envelopes around young stars. It may irradiate accretion disks in which planets form. It may ionize some of them. And that changes a lot of the physics and perhaps even of the chemistry in the environment of young stars, where planets are forming, where processes that lead to more evolved stages of the star formation take place. So that is something we have to begin to calculate now. We haven't done that yet.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Okay, well, thank you. Thanks a lot.
Manuel Gudl is lead author of a paper on hot plasma in the Orion Nebula. Read the paper in this week's Science. Well, now David Grimm, editor of Science's free online daily news service, Science Now, joins us for our usual roundup of other recent stories. Hi, David.
Hey, Rob.
So what stories do you have for us today?
Well, Rob, I've got three cool stories for you. We'll talk about how an environmental contaminant invades the womb, some unusual suspects in Lyme disease, and finally, learning from birds to create better flying machines.
What environmental toxin is getting into the womb?
Well, the toxin is arsenic, and arsenic contaminates drinking water throughout the world. It occurs both naturally and from industrial activities. And it's a big problem in several countries, especially in countries like Bangladesh, where tin production causes levels in drinking water to far exceed levels considered safe by the World Health Organization.
So what does arsenic exactly do when it gets into the body?
Well, low chronic exposure has been linked to a variety of illnesses, including diabetes and cancer. But this has all been in people. And a team of researchers wondered, if a mother is exposed to arsenic, could it affect her fetus as well?
So what did the researchers do?
So a team of researchers took blood and fingernail clippings from a number of infants and their mothers from a region of Thailand that had been heavily affected by tin mining. And they compared these samples to mothers and children who were not exposed to arsenic. And what they found is that in the kids whose mothers had been exposed to arsenic, there were 11 genes whose activity was much different than in kids whose mothers hadn't been exposed to arsenic. So it seemed to indicate that when mothers are exposed, something is changing genetically in their offspring. And that's worrisome because these genes that the researchers identified seem to play a role in cell death and cell growth and inflammation, all of which can be linked to cancer. So the idea is that if a mother is exposed to arsenic, she's going to have problems. But her fetus, when it's born, the child could later in life develop problems such as cancer and other disorders.
Well, this link, you say, between arsenic and cancer, I don't suppose there's any way to absolutely be sure, is there, with environmental toxins?
Yeah, it's always tricky with environmental toxins. And here, it was a relatively small study. They really only used a handful of newborns. So it's preliminary, it's interesting, but they would need to do this study on a much larger sample of people to be able to be more conclusive about whether it's arsenic and to be able to rule out other potential environmental contaminants.
So what can mothers do?
Well, in countries where it's available, they should think more about filtering their water if they can. But the fine really puts new urgency on monitoring arsenic levels in water, especially since the damage can be so long-lasting.
Well, from a chemical contaminant to a biological one, what's happening with Lyme disease and unusual suspects?
Well, Rob, as you may know, Lyme disease is transmitted by a black-legged tick, which has been infected by a bacteria, which is the bacteria that causes Lyme disease, which can cause everything from a rash to more severe symptoms like arthritic and psychiatric diseases. And researchers have long suspected that the main animal vector, as they say, that transmits this bacteria to humans is the white-footed mouse.
So the white-footed mouse is a sort of repository for this bacteria, and the ticks just pick it up and transmit it to humans?
Exactly. The bacteria multiplies in the mouse, the ticks feed on the mouse, and then the ticks bite humans, and humans contract the disease.
So the white-footed mouse is the usual suspect.
Right, but it turns out there are some unusual suspects. And the team of researchers first started suspecting that, hey, the white-footed mouse may not be our primary culprit. Some studies had suggested this. When researchers had vaccinated a bunch of white-footed mouse and released them back into the population, they found that the number of infected ticks really didn't go down that much. So it seemed to indicate that there were other animals out there that were harboring the bacterium. So a team of researchers conducted studies in the Hudson Valley in New York State. So they looked at a surface protein of the bacterium, which would give clues to the type of animals it was infecting. And what they found was that while the white-footed mouse accounted for about 25% of the total number of infected ticks, there were two shrews, the short-tail shrew and the mast shrew, which each accounted for another 25%. So already half of the infected ticks were becoming infected by feeding on shrews and not by feeding on mice. And what's more, chipmunks accounted for as much as 13% of infections. So really, when you add it all up, although mice are a problem, they only seem to be responsible for a quarter of the infected ticks. And you've got all these other animals that are playing a large role.
Well, all of these animals are ones that sort of scurry along the ground where the ticks are anyway.
Right. But some experts think that birds might play a role as well.
Birds?
Yes. Well, in the lab, at least, robins have been shown to be very good at transmitting the bacteria that causes Lyme disease as well. And they live very close to humans, so it's possible they're yet another unusual suspect that's out there.
Well, from birds as possible vectors for Lyme disease to taking cues from them on building better flying machines?
Right, and this story is about trying to build better aircraft, and specifically trying to build something called an unmanned aerial vehicle, which are these little flying aircraft that the military likes to use for reconnaissance and things of that nature. And researchers have always wanted to design flying machines that work a lot more like birds do. And the reason is because of the way birds fly, they can stay airborne over a wide range of speeds, and they're also maneuverable over a wide range of speeds. So if researchers could replicate this with an artificial aircraft, they could get something that's much better than the straight wing or rotating wing aircraft that we have today.
So is it a matter of building models and trying them out, or what do these researchers do?
Right. Well, obviously researchers have been trying to do this for a long time, so it's not as easy as it sounds. And the unique approach this team of researchers took was to use a computer program called an evolutionary algorithm. And what this is it basically replicates evolution on the computer screen. And they programmed the computer to design them something like a bird from scratch. And the computer went through several iterations, evolving designs, some of them that worked, some of them that didn't. And the computer, as evolution progressed, would toss the designs that didn't work and keep the designs that did. And over the course of the program, researchers plucked out the designs that they thought would work best. And what they did was, with these designs, they created a simulated unmanned aerial vehicle on the computer, and they found that with at least their simulation, it did work a lot like a bird did. It flew very efficiently at high speeds, but not so well at low speeds. But even with this preliminary data, they were able to design a prototype that replicated some of the effects they saw in their simulation. And now that they've actually got this tangible prototype, they can test more designs on it and try to even refine things better so they can end up potentially with an aerial vehicle that flies much like a bird does.
Will they need to create new materials? I imagine there must be incredible stresses, particularly on the parts where the wings are actually connected to the body.
Right, and there are still a lot of obstacles that need to be overcome. Anytime you have flapping wings, you need incredibly strong and resilient materials, and that's still a major roadblock. So you can see there's a number of roadblocks that still need to be overcome for this to become practical. But this is a promising development towards aircraft that might one day work much like birds do.
Would this be something that would ever carry passengers, or are we only talking about unmanned aerial vehicles here?
Well, another limitation is that these things tend to have to be quite small. So I think we're mainly talking about these unmanned vehicles that could be used for reconnaissance. I don't think this team is envisioning anything that would be anything like a passenger aircraft.
Okay, well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
What can we see coming up later on Science Now?
Well, we're looking to stories about teenage galaxies, about how cells invade other cells to die, and finally, the battle of the sexes in promiscuous antelopes. So be sure to check out the site.
David Grimm is the editor of Science Now, the free online daily news service of science. You can check out the latest science stories at sciencenow.sciencemag.org. Finally today, we read from some of your letters to science. Joining me is the journal's letters editor, Jennifer Sills.
This month, we received a lot of responses to science news writer Jeffrey Mervis's article, U.S. Output Flattens, and NSF Wonders Why.
That was from the August 3rd issue, in which Mervis wrote that the total output of U.S. scientists stopped growing in the early 1990s and hasn't budged since then.
John Moore writes in from Cornell University to say that the reason is simple.
Scientists are spending less time writing papers.
The reason is that scientists are spending more time on the increasingly burdensome administrative requirements of conducting science legally, writing, rewriting, and re-rewriting grant applications.
Ricky S. Hefner from the University of Toledo adds her own reason: regulatory compliance.
Because of the monumental effort to use animal or human subjects in research, discouraged investigators avoid pursuing experiments that require new approvals, even if the idea may only take a few days to test.
And the only mystery is why the flat output line has not yet turned down.
But that's where Stephen W. Director from Drexel University disagrees. Director writes in to say that telling a story by the numbers alone can sometimes mean a tale half told.
In particular, with data beyond 2001, Drexel University, possibly an exception, had a 130% increase in publication productivity.
From 502 articles in 2002 to 1,165 articles in 2006.
You can read these letters in the November 9th issue of Science.
Also from that issue, threats to privacy protection.
Carol Isaacson Barish writes in from the Genetics, Ethics, and Policy Consulting Company with praise for W.W. Lawrence and F.S. Collins' policy forum in the August 10th issue.
Assuring privacy protections in both genomic research and medicine practice is of urgent concern.
And protecting privacy is getting harder to do because de-identified data can be used to re-identify individuals.
So what constitutes adequate privacy protection? This question was addressed, Barish writes, in the 2004 U.S. appeals case, Northwestern Memorial Hospital versus John Ashcroft, in which the U.S. Attorney General, John Ashcroft, attempted to subpoena records of patients who had an abortion. Ashcroft wanted the records for use in a trial to challenge the constitutionality of the Partial Birth Abortion Ban Act of 2003.
While the records would have been anonymized prior to release, patients nonetheless protested that anonymization did not fully protect their privacy. The hospital won its case and did not release the records.
Turning now to this week's issue, a series of letters concerning the policy forum from August 10th.
Globalization of Conservation, a View from the South.
In that article, J.P. Rodriguez and colleagues argued that successful global strategies for biodiversity conservation require local leadership and an investment in local capacity.
But that large international non-governmental organizations, or INGOs, are increasingly setting the conservation agenda. And those generalized global approaches fail for biodiversity conservation at the local scale.
Eric Dinnerstein from the World Wildlife Fund writes into Science to disagree. He cites counterexamples from the World Wildlife Fund programs in Namibia for increased indigenous control over wildlife resources. And, off the coast of Mozambique, the largest marine reserve on the east coast of Africa.
F.R. Scarano from the Universidad Federal de Rio de Janeiro also writes in to say that large international NGOs do not force local NGOs out of the market.
At least in Brazil.
Scarano says that increases in the budget of the Brazilian Ministry for Environment parallel the range of increases in expenditure for global actions fostered by Conservation International and the World Wildlife Fund. INGOs, Scarano says, with strong Brazilian ties.
In response, Policy Forum author Rodriguez and his team note that while they're grateful to hear about cases of successful capacity building by INGOs, they don't think it's a trend.
Strengthening local capacity is not identified in the mission statements of major INGOs, nor is it systematically assessed.
Many institutions in developed countries rely on individual donations and endowments to cover core operating costs, sources rarely available in the developing world.
Therefore, local organizations often depend on international funds for their projects, which are frequently tied to priorities set by the INGOs. Unfortunately, these priorities are set according to corporate fundraising strategies instead of scientific consensus.
You can read the full back and forth in the letters section in the November 30th issue of Science.
Thanks, Jennifer.
Thanks, Rob.
Jennifer Sills is the letters editor for Science Magazine. If you enjoyed this letters segment of the podcast and would like to hear more, or have other comments about this segment or the podcast itself, please let us know. You can send your comments to our new email address, sciencepodcast@aaas.org. And that wraps up the November 30th, 2007 Science Podcast. The show is a production of Science Magazine and of AAAS, the Science Society, with additional financial support from the Golden Fund. The content is provided by the news and editorial staff of Science, and Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, thanks for joining us.